Good morning. Good morning, everyone. It's good to be gathered together for chapel this morning. It's the second of three in a series on faith, hope, and love inspired from First Corinthians 13 and also 12. And so we're excited about Joanne Gallardo bringing the message today.
1 Corinthians 13. If I speak in the tongues of men and angels, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and I have a faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I grew up, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love.
Good morning. Our speaker today will be Joanne Gallardo, and she will be talking to us about hope. And for Joanne, she is a campus pastor here, for those of you who don't know, and she has been in that role for 3 years. She attended Goshen College, where she obtained a music and Bible religion philosophy degree, and then she attended AMBS, where she got her MDiv. And I thought in order to get to know Joanne a little bit better, we might find out some things that she loves and some things she maybe doesn't like so much. So the first thing, when I asked Joanne what she loved, she said she loved coffee and she loves singing and that she loves her students, which she didn't say, but I'm sure includes faculty and staff as well. And for things she doesn't like when her feet get hot, but her body stays cold. So I don't know if you can relate to that, but yeah. And she hates sauerkraut, which is always a valuable piece of information to know about your speaker. But in all seriousness, Joanne is truly an amazing person, and anybody who has been around her can see the light that she brings. She is funny, insightful, and truly a woman of God, and I have really enjoyed getting to know her and working with her since coming to EMU. So will you join me in welcoming Joanne?
Wow, with an introduction like that. Good morning. I'm here to give my thoughts today on hope, thus being the middle of our series on faith, hope, and love, coming from 1 Corinthians 13, which Chaska read for us, our theme verse for this year. Carolyn started us off on Friday with faith, and Byron Peachy will follow this Friday with love. I chose hope, probably because I'm terrible at it. Being a pessimist, I probably gravitate more towards its opposite. But rather than pontificating on how I think hope is important, I'm not going to give that kind of talk. Rather, my thoughts on hope when I've not felt it at all. I hope you're doing well, 7! Was the first line of an email I received from one of my former college classmates a few months ago. She went on, I had hoped to see you when I was back at Christmas, but I guess I didn't. I hope that things are going well for you. I hope that I'm able to get a promotion sometime soon regarding her job. I hope to God he's not gonna leave me about her relationship. And signing off, I hope your week is a good one, with 7 more exclamation points. That's a lot of hope. The start of last year was a particularly rough one for me, and hope was not something I had a lot of, or something I could particularly tolerate when said in ways that seemed flippant or void. While I slammed my laptop shut in disgust over hope that was dripping all over the screen, I realized how much I said, "I hope," and didn't mean it, particularly regarding situations I knew had a difficult road ahead or a difficult ultimate ending. Did I really have hope? Or was I just looking for something to say? Do pastors throw around the word hope and hope that it means something to someone sometime? When I tell students, "I hope you fill in the blank," how often am I really thinking about what I'm saying to hope for something? Well, I'm not going to discourage anyone who's ever hoped and had something turn out exactly the way that they planned. There are many, many situations, as we all know, where hoping has seemed futile. And in that case, maybe hope needs to be redefined. For a dear seminary friend who died of cancer a few months ago, hope was always changing. Many people wrote on her Facebook wall, on her CaringBridge site, and in personal letters, "I hope for healing. I hope for a good lab result. I hope for strength for you." Meanwhile, healing was not coming. Lab results were negative and strength was waning. For those of you who surrounded Theo Yoder, maybe some of your hopes changed over the course of his illness. Hoping for healing seems like a naive supplication at a certain point, and on some days, hoping seems useless. 2 of my fellow seminarians had funerals this past spring, both hopeful people, but now both dead. No miracle came, no painless ending, no last-minute gleaning of some eternal wisdom straight from the mouth of God into human flesh, just sleep and then death. And left behind are children, both very young and adult, spouses, church families, friends, students, parishioners, whose hope was in having their parent, spouse, mentor, peer, friend not die so soon. And while the endings were as joyful as possible, they left me shaken up with the sense that hope, unlike love in the passage Chaska read, does fail. So I entered this new year, and hope was a word that I disdained. I spoke with several friends about this, both Christian and non-Christian, and found my non-Christian friends telling me about the power of positive thinking. Christians spouted verses about hoping in God, quoting hymns, because they know I love hymns, "It is well with my soul," which, by the way, never became more annoying to me than it has in the past semester. What happens when it is not well with your soul? "Whatever my lot thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." What if that lot is nothing but pain, suffering for you, for others, and for the world? The concept of hope made me uneasy, not only for what I had seen friends endure, but for problems going on in my own life. What was hope going to do? Could hope fix problems? Could hope make me feel comforted for maybe more than 10 minutes? Could hope change the course of the inevitable when I see myself and when I see students stuff their emotions, feelings, thoughts, memories, whole years of one's life down farther and farther, and then hope for the chance of life as usual? No, I don't think hope's big enough to handle that big of a mess, at least not hope as I knew it. I can't count the number of times I've cried on couches, at kitchen tables, in cars, via text, which, by the way, is a terrible way to communicate such things. I don't recommend it, but offer as a confession as someone who is both communicatively lazy and non-confrontational. But I've asked, "Is it going to be okay?" Or as I think of students who I see in my office, Common Grounds, or elsewhere, asking the exact same thing, "Is it going to be okay?" Hope is such a strong word, it was even used in Obama's campaign slogan in 2008, with the intentions of conjuring up feelings of good old American fortitude and endurance. And it worked. In philosophy, this hope, called meliorism, purports that metaphysical changes can happen over nature to produce a desired outcome. In other words, you can hope your way to achieve an end. Liberal democracy is based on this, human rights work is based on this. Heck, even Gandhi said, be the change you wish to see in the world. Hope has a force to it, its strength coming from the knowledge that one is maybe naturally hope-deprived or hopeless. When you ask someone, like me, which I'm asking myself the question, when are the times you felt hopeful, you're probably going to start with a time when you felt hopeless, or a situation that, at least at first blush, seemed hopeless. Hope assumes that one has not given up, that one believes something better is coming. What could happen might be better. People in power positions have used this word for centuries to keep oppressed people in an oppressed state, claiming that if they hoped a little longer, something better would come their way. Maybe not right now, but soon, in the future, in the afterlife, whenever. Just stick it out a little longer. Put up with it for just a short time. Hope hard enough, and that which you seek will be yours. Be that freedom, money, fame, security, love, happiness, general prosperity, whatever. This is not, I should say, biblical hope. Romans 8:20 says, "For creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, and hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and the glory of the children of God." That does not sound like God wants us to do these trials and prove our hope. What I hear this passage saying is that we do not always cause hopelessness to happen to us. It comes from the will of the one who subjected frustration. One is not capitalized here. This isn't referring to God subjecting us, trialing us to see if our faith, hope, and love are good enough. This is saying stuff happens, and I think you know what I mean by stuff, because the world is what it is, because situations are what they are, and because we and others make mistakes. We say things we don't mean, or that we do mean, responsible for our own actions, or somehow become responsible for the actions of others, or just because we live in a world that's fallen, fallenness happens. I think this passage is saying that our hope is to be liberated from bondage, to decay, meaning that something dies here in order to give birth to hope. In thinking about this passage, several things came to mind on what might need to die, to decay, what God would want to decay in our lives. What needs to die is the idea that we're not good enough. Why should we hope for a good school year when we're so disorganized, when we're so incompetent, and why did I choose this major anyway? What we should hope for, why should we hope for a better connection with people because we're so weird? No one gets us anyway. And if I would find friends, they'd probably be the wrong ones. The sense that we are not enough or not worthy of hope is something that does not come from God, but comes from a broken place that God longs to heal. What needs to die is a sense that hope means we never doubt, that we only have faith all the time, all day, every day, 24/7. Someone who says they've never had doubt is probably not being honest with themselves. Doubt is certainly not the opposite of faith, nor is it the opposite of hope. Doubt is as real as hope, and it's just as much part of the Christian life as faith, hope, and love. But what else has to die in order to give birth to hope? I think part of this is the sense that we are exempt from the human condition, putting to death the thought that we are the only ones who are hopeless. Disconnection, loneliness, isolation, these are only things that one experiences in college, but in life after college as well. How many perceived hopeless relationship problems are caused by a sense of feeling isolated from your significant other, How many friendships are broken from disconnection and feeling cut off? How many personal frustrations come when we don't feel worthy of connection or love or of being listened to? How much are we in search of things we think will separate us from loneliness and hopelessness? Maybe if we just found the right guy or the right woman, we could just marry them and not be lonely. That'll give me hope. Or I'll get on Facebook and maybe someone will connect with me. And then I can feel hopeful. Or if I'm around my friends all the time, I won't have to be by myself and feel hopeless. Maybe if I keep busy enough, I won't need to face anything. And how many times do we leave these relationships, these friendships, whatever, because the other person couldn't possibly meet all our needs and expectations? We place so much emphasis on the person, the place, or the thing that's going to take away the sense of despair and hopelessness that so many of us have, only to have it betray us, to leave us, or not meet our expectations. Then we become hopeless when we realize that no significant other heals our loneliness. No internet site makes us really feel more connected. No one friend helps us to combat our own issues of feeling despair. And we can become bitter and hopeless. In the play Night Mother, which happens over the course of one evening, the main character, Jessie, who is an epileptic, spends the evening of her planned suicide with her mother, Thelma. This results in several deep, moving conversations as they realize her time is coming to an end. Her mother, having had no idea this utter hopelessness Jessie has felt before that night, promises to spend more time listening to her and telling her the truth, particularly about her brother and sister-in-law, Dawson and Loretta, and her ex-husband and son, Cecil and Ricky, all who have caused major problems in Jessie's life. Her response to her mother's exhortation that she knows exactly how she feels is, "No, Mama. We wouldn't have more talks like tonight because it's the next part that has made this part so good, Mama. No, Mama, this is how I have my say. This is how I say what I thought about it all, and I say no. No to Dawson and Loretta and the problems on TV, and epilepsy, and Ricky and Cecil, and you, and me, and hope. I say no." Saying no to hope is what Jessie did by ending her life, and I feel deeply for all the people who have felt that the only say they have for their circumstances is to end their life, the ultimate act of acting on hopelessness. What the author, Henry Nouwen, the prolific Catholic priest, says about ministering to others is that hopelessness and destructiveness, suicide being the ultimate destructive act, can be invitations to allow others to come into our own pain, of our own experience of hopelessness, and to just sit for a while. What if those who said no had a place to say no, and to have it be accepted and understood? Not in the sense of, "Oh, I've been exactly where you are, I know exactly how you feel," but really understood, even shared. Nouwen calls this true hospitality. If we open our houses, ourselves, to the stranger and let them in, both the recipient and the person offering hospitality can receive healing. And what does it mean to open our house to the stranger? What does it mean to be vulnerable with our own hopelessness? The times when we have been without hope and offering that up. People that are at home with their own hopelessness and despair that we all face has the ability to truly open themselves to another, to create a community of understood experience. Once we realize our own condition, we're able to invite others into it. Not into our own mess or to our own issues, but to a place where one is free to be who they are. Where it's okay to be hopeless. It's okay to not have everything figured out. It's okay to deal with things in the way that we deal with things. It's okay to close off sometimes. It's okay to get anxious. It's okay to have not always made the right choices. To invite others into the space of being who they really are, that is real hospitality. The same perils of hopelessness happens to ministers, particularly to ministers. And like I tell my ministry assistants over and over, we are all ministering people. No sermon is ever quite the life-altering prophetic declaration that we hoped it would be. And pastoral care visits can be very much unwelcome. As Nouwen says, ministers want to touch the very heart of people's lives, but often stand on the periphery, waiting to be let in, and sometimes, oftentimes, being shut out. Ministers often have the wrong idea, and I think people in community have this idea that we're supposed to prevent people from being hopeless, confused, or doubtful. We want people to be happy, right? No one can come through college, come through life, and have not have had these feelings, because we are broken people. As Nouwen states, we can only offer ourselves as guides to fearful people. Yet paradoxically, it's precisely in this guidance that the first signs of hope become visible. This is because a shared pain is no longer paralyzing, but mobilizing, when it is understood to be a way to liberation. When we become aware that we do not have to escape our pains, but that we can mobilize them in a common search for life, those very pains transform from expressions of despair into signs of hope. There is no magical cure for hopelessness. The Christian life is certainly no escape into some bubble where hopelessness and despair don't happen. In fact, I think Christian communities can further this concept. We take the concept of separating the wheat from the chaff so seriously that we throw out everything. Unfortunately, that everything can include people. We exclude the very people we are called to love. And where does that leave them? And where does that leave us? What kind of beacon of hope are we supposed to be when our words and actions say you're wrong? You're not good enough, and you're excluded. As a pastor, but also as a friend, I get the question a lot, is it going to be okay? What's going to happen? Sometimes I'm pretty sure. Sometimes I have no idea. I appreciate and hate the question all at the same time. How in the world am I supposed to answer an existential question like that? Sometimes I can answer with some certainty, yes, it'll be okay, but many times I simply don't know. And I'm pretty clear about that, or at least I hope I'm clear in my response. I have no idea if it'll be okay. I don't know the mind of God. I certainly haven't mastered the mystery of God. But I do know that I'll be there, and I do know that God will be there, and that's as much as I can offer. And that's as much as any of us can offer to be there. Even Jesus' disciples, who were feeling cheated out of more time with Jesus, were protesting when he kept talking of being around for only a little while. He promised to send the Paraclete, an advocate, to be Emmanuel, God with us. As Christ followers, we have nothing to offer but ourselves to be advocates for one another. We offer, as ministering people of the gospel, our hospitality to be servants to one another and open a door, a free evening, a time to vent, a time to cry, holding a hand, dinner, breakfast, whatever. We offer it as a hospitable, holy space to sit with the hopelessness as part of our shared experience and offer hope when the other needs it. One of our PAs talked about her mentor in the honors program telling her that the church can hold faith for us even when we can't hold it for ourselves. And if there's anything I want to communicate today, it's that people are there to hold hope for you even when you can't hold it for yourself. All of these things, faith, hope, love, can be held by others even when we don't have it for ourselves. Because we have experienced being without hope, we can hold hope for others. And the other isn't offering an empty hope. They aren't putting their arm around you saying, cheer up or just trust Jesus. They're opening a space for you to sit with your hopelessness and to share some of their own. We're in community not just for the experience of being in community, but for stability. As the author Anne Lamott puts it, the reason life works at all is because not everyone in your tribe is nuts on the same day. Which is very true, but I believe the same is true of hopelessness, that everyone is hopeless on the same day. As the Christian body, we have the strength to hold hope for the most hopeless of our members and keep it until they're ready to hold it for themselves. The song, Will You Let Me Be Your Servant, is a particularly meaningful hymn for the communities of faith I've been a part of, mostly because of the community aspect of shared experience of faith, hope, and love. Last year, when Carolyn Stauffer spoke in chapel, she spoke of a time that she was told that if she wanted to go a little ways, she could go by herself. But if she wanted to go far, you have to take someone with you. And all of us here, I think, know that our journey is a long one. There's some downhill, and there's a heck of a lot of uphill. But for both of those times, we need others with us. And of course, Emmanuel, God with us. Amen.
And so if you have time, take the long way back to the office, to your next class, but don't be late, to your home. Linger and reflect on these things, the wholeness, the fullness, the depth of hope. Maybe talk with another on the way. Let us go in the spirit of God's grace for us.